Bois, you say? Oh, yes. And would you like another drink? It's a celebration, after all. Glenda looked around at the chattering, laughing, and above all, drinking crowd. The place felt like an oven. All right, but not that sherry, thank you all the same. Have you got something very cold and fizzy? Why, yes, miss, lots. The girl produced a large bottle and expertly filled a tall, fluted glass with, apparently, bubbles. When Glenda drank it, the bubbles filled her, too. Quite nice, she ventured. A bit like lemonade grown up. That's how Madame drinks it, certainly. This boudoir, Glenda tried, following the girl rather unsteadily. How big is it? Oh, pretty large, I think. There must be about 40 people in there already. Really? That's a big boudoir. Well, thank goodness, Glenda thought. That at least is sorted out. They really ought to put proper explanations in these novels. She had never been sure, given that she had no idea what sort of thing a boudoir was, what sort of thing you would find in it when you did. She found that it contained people, heat and flowers. Not flowers in bunches, but in pillars and towering stacks, filling most of the air with clouds of sticky perfume, while the people below filled the rest of it with words, tightly packed. No one could possibly hear what they were saying, Glenda told herself, but perhaps that wasn't important. Perhaps what was important was being there to be seen to say it. The crowd parted, and she saw Juliet, still in the glittering outfit, still in the beard, being there. Salamanders were flashing on and off, which meant people with iconographs, didn't it? The trashy papers were full of people glittering for the picture. She had no time for them. What made it worse was that her disapproval mattered not a fig to anyone. The people glittered anyway, and here was Juliet, glittering most of all. "I think I could do with a little fresh air," she mumbled. Her guide led her gently to an unobtrusive doorway. "Restrooms through here, ma'am." And they were, except that the long, carefully lit room was like some kind of fairy tale, all velvet and drapes. 15 surprised visions of Glenda stared at her from as many mirrors. It was overpowering enough to make her sit down in a very expensive bendy-leg chair that turned out to be very restful, too. When she jerked awake, she staggered out, got lost in a dark world of smelly passages choked with packing cases, and finally blundered into a very large room indeed. It was more like a cavern. At the far end were a pair of double doors, probably ashamed to let in a grey light which did not so much illuminate as accuse. Another chaos of empty clothes racks and packing cases was scattered around the floor. In one place, water had dripped from the roof, and a puddle had formed on the stone, soaking some cardboard. "There they are, in there with their glitter and their finery, and it's all muck and rubbish round the back, right, dear?" said a voice in the dark. "You look like a lady who can spot a metaphor when she stares it in the face." "Something like that," muttered Glenda. "Who's doing the asking?" An orange light glowed and faded in the gloom. Someone was smoking a cigarette in the shadows. "It's the same all over, love. If there was an award for the arse end of things, there'd be a real bloody squabble for first place. I've seen a few palaces in my time, and they're all the same. Turrets and banners in the front, maids' bedrooms and water pipes round the back. Fancy a top-up? Can't be walking around here with an empty glass, you'll stand out." The cooler air was making her feel better. She still had a glass in her hand. "What is this stuff?" "Well, if this was any other party, it'd probably be the cheapest fizzing wine you could strain through a sock. But Madame won't stint. It's the real stuff. Champagne." "What? I thought only nobby people drank that." "No, just people with money, love. Sometimes it's the same thing." She looked closer and gasped. "What? Are you Pepe?" "That's me, love." "But you're not all... She waved her hands frantically. "Off duty, love. Don't have to worry about..." He waved his hands equally frantically. "I've got a bottle here of our very own. Care to join me?" "Well, I ought to be getting back in there." "Why? To fuss around her like an old hen? Leave her be, love. She's a duck who's just found water." Pepe looked taller in this gloom. Maybe it was the language and the lack of flapping. And, of course, anyone next to Madame Charn would look small. He was willowy, though, like someone made of sinews. "But anything could happen to her." Pepe's grin gleamed. "Yes, but probably won't." My word, she sold micromail for us, and no mistake. Told Madame I had a good failing. She's got a great career in front of her. No, she's got a good, steady job in the night kitchen with me, said Glenda. It might not be big money, but it'll turn up every week, on the nail, and she won't lose it if someone prettier comes along.
Dolly Sisters, right? Sounds like the Botany Street area, said Pepe. I'm sure of it. Not too bad, as I recall. I didn't get beaten up much down there, but at the end of the day, they're all crab buckets.
Glenda was taken aback. She'd expected anger or condescension, not this sharp little grin.
You know a lot about our city for a dwarf from Oberwald, I must say.
No, love, I know a lot about Oberwald for a boy from Lobbin Clout, said Pepe smoothly. Old Cheese Alley, to be precise. Local lad, me. Wasn't always a dwarf, you know, I just joined.
What, can you do that?
Well, it's not like they advertised, but yeah, if you know the right people, and Madame knew the right people. Ha! Knew quite a lot about the right people. It wasn't hard. I've got to believe in a few things, there's a few observances, and of course I have to keep off the old booze. He smiled as her glance pinned the glass in his hand and went on. Too quick, love, I was going to add, when I'm working, and good job too. It doesn't matter if you are shoring up the mine roof or riveting a bodice. Being a piss artist is bloody stupid, and the moral of all this is, you have to grab life or drop back into the crab bucket.
Oh, yes, that's all very well to say, Glenda snapped,
wondering what crabs had got to do with anything. But in real life, people have responsibilities. We don't have shiny jobs with lots of money, but they are real jobs doing things that people need. I'd be ashamed of myself. Selling boots at $400 a go, which only rich people can afford, what's the point of that?
"Well, you must admit that it makes rich people less rich," said the chocolate voice of Madame behind her. Like many large people, she could move as quietly as the balloon she resembled. "That's a good start, isn't it? And it goes to wages for the miners and the smiths. It all goes around, they tell me."
She sat down heavily on a packing case, glass in hand.
"Well, we've got most of them out now," she said, fumbling in her capacious breastplate with her spare hand and pulling out a thick wad of paper. The big names want to be in on this, and everyone wants it exclusively, and we're going to need another forge. Tomorrow I'll go and see the bank. She paused to dip into her metal bodice again. As a dwarf, I was raised in the faith that gold is the one true currency, she said, counting out some crisp notes. But I have to admit, this stuff is a lot warmer. That's $50 for Juliet, 25 from me, and 25 from the champagne, which is feeling happy. Juliet said to give it to you to look after.
"Miss Glenda thinks we'll lead her treasure into a lifetime of worthless sin and depravity," said Pepe.
"Well, that's a thought," said Madame, "but I can't remember when I last had some depravity."
"Tuesday," said Pepe.
"A whole box of chocolates is not depraved. Besides, you slid out the car between the layers, which confused me. I did not intend to eat the bottom layer. I did not want the bottom layer. It was practically assault."
Pepe coughed. "We're scaring the normal lady, love," Madame smiled.
"Glenda, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking we're a couple of louche, evil clowns who booze away in a world of smoke and mirrors. Well, that's fairly accurate right now, but today was the end of a year's hard work, you see."
"And you bicker like an old married couple," Glenda thought. Her head was aching. She'd tried a rat fruit, that was the trouble, she was sure of it.
"In the morning, I'm going to show these orders to the manager of the Royal Bank and ask him for a lot of money. If he trusts us, can you? We need Juliet. She just sparkles."
"And you two are holding hands tightly." Something soft snapped inside Glenda. "All right, look," she said. "It's like this. Jules is going to come back home with me tonight to get her head straight. Tomorrow, well, we'll see."
"We can't ask for more than that, can we?" said Madame, patting Glenda on the knee. "You know, Juliet thinks the world of you. She said she'd need you to say yes. She was telling all the society ladies about your pies."
"She's been talking to society ladies?" said Glenda, in astonishment, laced with trepidation, and tinted with wonder.
"Certainly. They all wanted a close look at the micromail, and she just chatted away, cheery as you like. I don't think anyone ever said watcher to them in their lives before. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Why be? They were rather taken by it. And apparently you can bake pickled onions into a pie so that they stay crunchy. She told them that? Oh, yes. I gather that they all intend to get their cooks to try it out. Ha! They'll never find a way, said Glenda with satisfaction. So Jules says. We generally call her Juliet, said Glenda. She told us to call her Jules, said Madame. Is there a problem? Well, no, not really a problem, Glenda began wretchedly. That's good, then, said Madame, who clearly knew when not to notice subtleties. Now let's prize her away from her new friends, and you can see to it that she gets a good night's sleep. There was laughter, and the girls helping with the show streamed out into the clammy place that was the midwife to beauty. Juliet was among them, and with the loudest laugh. She broke away when she saw Glenda and gave her another hug. "Oh, Glendy, isn't this great? It's like a fairy story." "Yes, well, it might be," said Glenda. "But they don't all have happy endings. Just you remember, you have a good job now with prospects and regular leftovers to take home. That's not to be lightly thrown away." "No, it should be hurled with great force," said Pepe. "I mean, what is this? Emberella? The wand has been waved. The court is cheering. A score of handsome princes are waiting to sign up for just a sniff of her slipper. And you want her to go back to work making pumpkins?" He looked at their blank faces. "All right. Perhaps that came out a little confused, but surely you can follow the seam. This is a big chance, as big as it gets. A way out of the bucket." "I think we'll go home now," said Glenda primly. "Come along, Jules." "See," said Pepe when they had gone. "It's a crab bucket." Madame peered into a bottle to see if, against all probability, one glassful yet remained. "Did you know she more or less raised the kid? Jules will do what she says." "What a waste," said Pepe. "Don't take the world by storm. Stay here and make pies. You think that's a life?"
"Someone has to make pies," Madame said, with an infuriating calm reasonableness.
"Oh, please, not her. Let it not be her. And for leftovers, oh, no."
Madame picked up another empty bottle. She knew it was empty because it was in the vicinity of Pepe at the end of a long day, but she examined it anyway because thirst springs eternal.
"It might not come to that," she said. "I have a feeling that Miss Glenda is just about to start thinking. There's a powerful mind behind that rather sad cloak and those awful shoes. Today might be its lucky day."
Ridcully strode through the corridors of Unseen University with his robes flapping confidently behind him. He had a big stride, and Ponder had to run in a semi-crab-wise fashion to keep up with him, his clipboard clutched protectively to his chest. "You know, we did agree that it wasn't to be used for purposes other than pure research, Arch-Chancellor. You actually signed the edict."
"Did I? I don't remember that, Stibbons."
"I remember it most distinctly, sir. It was just after the case of Mr. Floribunda."
"Which one was he?" said Ridcully, still striding purposefully ahead.
"He was the one who felt a little peckish and asked the Cabinet for a bacon sandwich to see what would happen."
"I thought that anything taken out of the Cabinet had to be returned in 14.14 hours recurring."
"Yes, sir, that is the case, but the Cabinet appears to have strange rules that we do not fully understand. In any case, Mr. Floribunda's defence was that he thought the 14-hour rule didn't apply to bacon sandwiches. Nor did he tell anybody, and so the students on his floor were only alerted when they heard the scream some 14 hours later."
"Correct me if I'm wrong," said Ridcully, still covering the flagstones at an impressive rate, "but would it not have been digested by that point?"
"Yes, sir, but it still went back to the Cabinet of its own accord, you might say. That was quite an interesting discovery. We did not know that could happen." Ridcully stopped and Ponder bumped into him.
"What exactly did happen to him?"
"You wouldn't want me to draw a picture, sir. However, the good news is that he will soon be out of the wheelchair. In fact, I gather he's already walking quite well with a stick. How we discipline him is, of course, up to you, sir. The file is on your desk, as are indeed a considerable number of other documents."
Ridcully strode off again. "He did it to see what would happen, did he?" he said cheerfully.
"So he said, sir," said Ponder.
And this was against my express orders, was it?
Yes, absolutely, definitely, sir, said Ponder, who knew his arch-chancellor and already had an inkling of how this one was going to end. And so, therefore, sir, I must insist that he...
He walked into Ridcully again because the man had stopped outside a large door on which was a bright red notice saying, No item to be removed from this room without the express permission of the Arch-Chancellor. Signed, Ponder Stibbons, P.P., Mustrum, Ridcully.
You signed this one for me, Ridcully said.
Yes, sir. You were busy at the time and we had agreed on this one.
Yes, of course. But I don't think that you should P.P. just like that. Remember what that young lady said about the U.U.?
Ponder produced a large key and opened the door.
May I also remind you, Arch-Chancellor, that we agreed a moratorium on the use of the Cabinet of Curiosity until we had cleaned up some of the residual magic in the building. We still don't seem to have got rid of the squid.
Did we agree, Mr. Stibbons? Said Ridcully, turning around sharply. Or did you agree with yourself, P.P. me, as it were?
Well, I think I understood the spirit of your thinking, sir.
Well, this is the spirit of pure research, said Ridcully. It's research into how we can hope to save our cheese board. Many would say there could be no greater goal. As for young Floribunda...
Yes, sir, said Ponder wearily.
Promote him. Whatever level he is, move him up one.
I think that'll send the wrong kind of signal, Ponder tried.
On the contrary, Mr. Stibbons. It will send exactly the right message to the student body.
But he disobeyed an express order, may I point out.
That's right. He showed independent thinking and a certain amount of pluck, and in the course of so doing, added valuable data to our understanding of the Cabinet.
But he might have destroyed the whole university, sir.
Right. In which case, he would have been vigorously disciplined, if we'd been able to find anything left of him. But he didn't, and he was lucky, and we need lucky wizards. Promote him on the direct order of me, not PP'd at all. Incidentally, how loud were his screams?
As a matter of fact, Arch-Chancellor, the first one was so heartfelt that it kept going long after he'd run out of breath, and apparently adopted an independent existence. Residual magic again. We've had to lock it in one of the cellars.
Did he actually say what the bacon sandwich was like?
Coming or leaving, sir, said Ponder.
Only coming, I think, said Ridcully. I do have a vivid imagination, after all.
He said it was the most delightful bacon sandwich he'd ever eaten. It was the bacon sandwich that you dream of when you hear the words bacon sandwich and never, ever quite get.
With brown sauce, said Ridcully.
Of course. Apparently, it was the bacon sandwich to end all bacon sandwiches.
It nearly did for him. But isn't that what you already know about the Cabinet? That it always delivers a perfect specimen?
Actually, we know very little for certain, said Ponder. What we do know is that it will hold nothing too large to fit inside a cube measuring 14.14 inches recurring on a side, that it will cease working if, we now know, a non-organic object is not replaced in it in 14.14 hours recurring, and that none of its contents are pink, although we do not know why this should be.
But bacon is definitely organic, Mr. Stibbons, said Ridcully.
Ponder sighed.
Yes, sir, we don't know why that is either.
The Arch-Chancellor took pity on him.
Perhaps it's one of those very crispy ones, he suggested kindly. The kind that you can break between your fingers. I like that in a bacon sandwich.
The door swung open, and there it was. Small, in the centre of a very large room. The Cabinet of Curiosity.
Do you think this is wise? Said Ponder.
Of course not, said Ridcully. Now, find me a football.
On one wall was a white mask, such as one might wear to a carnival. Ponder turned towards it.
Hex, please find me a ball suitable for the game of football.
That mask is new, said Ridcully. I thought Hex's voice travelled in blit space.
Yes, sir. It just comes out of the air, sir, but somehow, well, it feels better to have something to talk to.
What shape football do you require? Said Hex, his voice as smooth as clarified butter. Oval or spherical?
Spherical, said Ponder.
Instantly, the cabinet shook. The thing had always worried Ridcully. It looked too smug, for a start. It seemed to be saying, you don't know what you are doing. You use me as a kind of lucky dip, and I bet you have never thought of how many dangerous things can fit into a 14-inch cube. In fact, Ridcully had thought about that, often at 3 in the morning, and never went into the room without a couple of subcritical spells in his pocket, just in case. And then there was Nut. Well... Hope for the best and prepare for the worst. That was the UU way. A drawer slid out, and went on sliding until it reached the wall, and presumably continued to slide into some other hospitable set of dimensions, because it never turned up outside the room, no matter how often you looked.
"Very smooth today," he observed, as another drawer rose up from under the floor and sprouted a further drawer exactly the same size as itself, which began to move purposefully towards the far wall.
"Yes, the lads at Brazenek have come up with a new algorithm for handling wave spaces in higher-level Blit. It speeds up something like the cabinet by getting on for 2,000 drinkies."
Ridcully frowned. "Did you just make that up?"
"No, sir. Charlie Drinky came up with it at Brazenek. It's a shorter way of saying 15,000 iterations to the first negative blitz, and it's a lot easier to remember."
"So people you know at Brazenek send you stuff," said Ridcully.
"Oh, yes," said Ponder.
"For free?"
"Of course, sir," said Ponder, looking surprised. "The free sharing of information is central to the pursuit of natural philosophy."
"And so you tell them things, do you?"
Ponder sighed. "Yes, of course."
"I don't think I approve of that," said Ridcully. "I'm all for the free sharing of information, providing it's them sharing their information with us."
"Yes, sir, but I think we're rather hampered by the meaning of the word sharing."
"Nevertheless," Ridcully began, and stopped.
A sound, so quiet that they had barely noticed it, had stopped. The cabinet of curiosity had folded itself up and was once again just a piece of wooden furniture in the centre of the room. But as they looked at it, its two front doors opened, and a brown ball dropped onto the floor and bounced with a sound like glowing. Ridcully marched over and picked it up, turning it in his hands.
"Interesting," he said, slamming it towards the floor.
It bounced up past his head, but he was quick enough to catch it on the way down.
"Remarkable," he said. "What do you think of this, Stibbons?"
He flicked the ball into the air and kicked it hard across the room. It came back towards Ponder, who, to his own amazement, caught it.
"Seems to have a life of its own."
Ponder dropped it onto the floor and tried a kick. It flew. Ponder Stibbons was the quintessential all-time holder of the 100-metre note from his auntie, which also asked for him to be excused all sporting activities on account of his athlete's ear, erratic stigmatism, a grumbling nose and a revolving spleen. By his own admission, he would rather run 10 miles, leap a 5-bar gate and climb a big hill than engage in any athletic activity. The ball sang to him. It sang glowing. A few minutes later, he and Ridcully walked back to the great hall, occasionally bouncing the ball on the flagstones. There was something about the sound of glowing that made you want to hear it again.
"You know, Ponder, I think you've been doing it all wrong. There are more things in heaven and disc than are dreamed of in our philosophies."
"I expect so, sir. I don't have any things in my philosophies."
"It's all about the ball," said Ridcully, slamming it down hard on the flagstones again and catching it. "Tomorrow, we'll bring it here and see what happens. You gave the ball a mighty kick, Mr. Stibbons, and yet you are, by your own admission, a wet and a weed."
"Yes, sir, and a wuss, and I'm proud of the appellation. I'd better remind you, Arch-Chancellor, that the thing mustn't spend too long outside the cabinet." Glowing.
"But we could make a copy, couldn't we?" said Ridcully. "It's only leather stitched together, probably protecting a bladder of some sort. Bet any decent craftsman could make another one for us."
"What now?"
"The lights never go off on the Street of Cunning Artificers."
By now, they were back in the great hall, and Ridcully looked around until his gaze lighted on two figures pushing a trolley laden with candles.
"You lads, to me!" he shouted.
They stopped pushing the trolley and walked over to him.
"Mr. Stibbons here would like you to run an errand for him. It's of considerable importance. Who are you?"
"Trevor Likely, Gov."
"Nut, Arch-Chancellor." Ridcully's eyes narrowed.
"Yes, nut," he said, and thought about the spells in his pocket. "The candle dribbler, yes? Well, you can make yourselves useful. Over to you, Mr. Stibbons."
Ponder Stibbons held out the ball.
"Have you any idea what this is?"
Nut took it out of his hands and bounced it on the tiles a couple of times. Glowing, glowing.
"Yes, it appears to be a simple sphere, although technically I believe it to be, in actual fact, a truncated isohedron, made by stitching together a number of pentagons and hexagons of tough leather, and stitching means holes and holes let the air leak. Ah, there is lacing just here, you see. There must be some internal bladder, animal, probably, a balloon, as it were, for lightness and elasticity, encapsulated by leather, simple and elegant."
He handed the ball back to Ponder, who was open-mouthed.
"Do you know everything, Mr. Nut?" he said, with the sarcasm of a born pedagogue.
Nut's reply was concentrated, and there was a lengthy pause before he said,
"I'm not sure about a lot of the details, sir."
Ponder heard a snigger behind him and felt himself ridden. He'd been cheeked,
by a dribbler, even if Nut was the most incontinently erudite one he'd ever encountered.
"Do you know where a copy of this may be made?" said Ridcully loudly.
"I expect so," said Nut. "I believe Dwarf Rubber will be our friend here."
"There's plenty of dwarfs up at Old Cobbler's who could knock one up, Gov," said Trev. "They're good at this sort of thing, but they'd want paying. They always want paying. Nothing's on credit when you're dealing with a dwarf.
Give these young gentlemen $25, Mr. Stibbons, will you?"
"That's a lot of money, Arch-Chancellor."
"Yes, well, dwarfs, while the salt of the earth, don't have much of a grasp of small numbers, and I want this in a hurry. I'm sure I can trust Mr. Likely and Mr. Nut with the money, can't I?"
He said it jovially, but there was an edge to his voice. Trev, at least, got the message very quickly. A wizard could trust you because of the hellish future he could unleash on you if his trust was betrayed.
"You can certainly trust us, Gov."
"Yes, I thought I could," said Ridcully.
When they had gone, Ponder Stibbons said, "You're entrusting them with $25?
"Yes, indeed," said Ridcully cheerfully. "It will be interesting to see the outcome."
"Nevertheless, sir, I have to say that it was an unwise move."
"Thank you for your input, Mr. Stibbons, but may I gently remind you who is the Gov around here?"
Glenda and Juliet took a trolley bus home, another huge extravagance, but, of course, Glenda was carrying more money than she had ever seen at one go. She had stuffed the notes into her bodice, à la madame, and it seemed to generate a heat of its own. You were safe on a troll. Anyone wanting to mug a troll would have to use a building on a stick. Juliet was quiet. This puzzled Glenda. She had expected her to bubble like a fountain full of soap flakes. The silence was unnerving.
"Look, I know it was a lot of fun," Glenda said, "but showing off clothes isn't like a real job, is it?"
"No, real jobs pay a lot less," she thought. And where had that come from? Jules hadn't opened her mouth, and the troll was still covered in mountain lichen and had a single-syllable vocabulary. "It came from me," she thought. "This is about dreams, isn't it? She is a dream. I dare say the micromail is good stuff, but she made it sparkle." "And what can I say? You help in the kitchen. You are useful and helpful, at least when you're not daydreaming. But you don't know how to keep accounts or plan a weekly menu. What would you do without me? How would you get on away from here in foreign parts where folks are so odd?"
"I'll have to open a bank account for you," she said aloud. "It'll be our little secret, all right. It'll be a nice little nest egg for you."
"And if Dad don't know I've got the money, he won't get it off me and piss it against the wall," said Juliet, glancing up at the solemn, impassive face of the troll.
If Glenda had known how to say, "Pardevant le troll," she would have done so. But it was true. Mr. Stollop commanded that all family earnings were pooled, with him holding the pool, which was then pooled with his friends in the bar of the Turkey and Vegetables, and ultimately pooled again in the reeking alley behind it. She settled for, "I wouldn't put it quite like that." Glowing, glowing. The new ball was magic, that's what it was. It bounced back to Trev's waiting hand as if by its own free will. For two pins he'd risk kicking it, but he and Nut and the ball were already picking up a trail of curious street urchins, such that he would be guaranteed never to see it again.
"Are you really sure you know how it works?" he said to Nut.
"Oh yes, Mr. Trev, it's a lot simpler than it looks, although the polyhedrons will need some work, but overall..." A hand landed on Trev's shoulder.
"Well now, Trev Likely," said Andy. "Andy's little pet, harder to kill than a cockroach, by all accounts. Something's going on, ain't it, Trev? And you're going to tell me what it is. Here, what's that you're holding?"
"Not today, Andy," said Trev, backing away. "You're lucky you didn't end up in the tanty, with Mr. One Drop measuring you up for a hemp collar."
"Me?" said Andy, innocently. "I didn't do a thing. Can't blame me for what a thicko Stollop does. But something's going on with the football, ain't it? Veterinari wants to muck it about."
"Just leave it alone, will you?" said Trev. There was more than the usual gang behind Andy. The Stollop brothers had sensibly spared the streets their presence lately, but people like Andy could always find followers. Like they said, it was better to be beside Andy than in front of him, and with Andy, you never knew just when he was... The cutlass was out in one movement. That was Andy. Whatever it was inside that held back the primeval rage could flick off just like that. And here came the blade with Trev's future written on it in very short words. And it stopped in mid-air, and Nut's voice said, "I believe I could squeeze with enough pressure, Andy, to make your bones grind and flow. There are 27 bones in the human hand. I truly believe that I could make every one of them useless with the slightest extra pressure. However, I would like to give you a chance to revise your current intentions."
Andy's face was a mix of colours, a white that was almost blue, and a rage that was almost crimson. He was trying to pull away, and Nutt stood calmly and was completely immovable.
"Get him!"